The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is That Corpse You Planted Last Year in Your Garden by Stacy Berg, B-E-R-G. Plants comb the dirt in rows, sparser than Damick had hoped. The greenhouse windows sweat, dripping clear trails against the fogged glass. There's a fog outside, too. The light dispersed so evenly it looks opaque. Behind the clouds, an occasional brighter light flashes. The low rumble rattles the panes. Moving away, Damick tries to tell himself. He doesn't count the intervals, not wanting to know otherwise. He wipes moisture from his scalp, fingers drawing a few hairs across the barren patch. The vanity, so absurd in the face of this madness, shames him. He glances at Mabali, but she hasn't noticed. She's watching the bees. The calm on her face shames him, too. He knows he looks the way he feels. Shame flickers into anger, comes out as accusation in his voice. It has to work this time. It's our last chance. She doesn't look at him. We still have the sequences. We don't have any more eggs to put them in, he starts to say. But she knows that already. She stands bent a little, one hand resting low against her belly, where fresh red stains her shift. Wings hum, the frequency rising and falling as the bees drone through their programmed dance. All the flowers have blossomed that are going to. Thumbnail-sized fruits hang fleshy and pink against the white petals. The stems sag under their slight weight. A meager harvest measured against the coming winter. Damick, feeling that long chill despite the greenhouse heat, shivers. I saw real bees once, Mabali says. My parents took me to an exhibit at the museum. The four. Damick can hardly remember before. For an instant, he hates her for reminding him. Then he notices. Beneath the calm, her dark skin has turned sallow. She's breathing wetly, as if the rain has gotten into her lungs, and her teeth chatter despite the sweat beading on her face. I'll just sit down for a minute, she says, and her legs fold beneath her. He helps her settle against the glass wall. She squeezes his hand once with burning fingers, then lets go. A bee crawls across her face. The tiny bots were his creation. He designed them to feed, clean, protect, and they persist as if those tasks have meaning still. The hive is buried, the queen code running on its own. Enough energy sealed in tiny cells to feed it forever. The world won't last that long. After a little while, he turns back to the garden. The leaves have changed already, the plant cells dissolved, the cellulose scaffold turned into skin, veins, arteries. The woody stems transformed to bone. Once parts and organs were farmed for transplant. Now there's no one to receive them. No one at all if this crop fails. Windows rattle again. The bee's drone sharpens into an angry buzz. There, midway along one row, worker bots swarm around a fruit shaken loose. Damick swats them away. A needle-sharp antenna pricks his thumb. He sucks at the sting. The bees stream away through a crack into the underworld. With his heel, he scrapes a depression in the dirt, then tows the fallen fruit into it. The rest of them will fall too, yesterday or tomorrow. It is programmed into them, like the bee's code, like his own corruption. Once, in his vanity, he imagined if and then the return of his flesh to its elements, endless cycle of scattering and taking up again. Now there is only when, which is now. He sinks into the dirt alongside them. All the tiny, perfect humans languishing on the stalks, bending towards the dust like tears dropping from a blind white eye.
This is Dan Oliver reading The Converse by Philip Apps. What do you think happens to people in a dream when the dreamer wakes up? She asked. He thought about the question and looked at her. She was pale and slender, with long black hair, dark eyes, and an accent he could not quite place. They were sitting in a favorite cafe of his, sipping coffee. Well, he said, thinking it through, there are no people as such. It's all just in the dreamer's imagination, so there's no them for anything to happen to, if you follow. An interesting view, she said, neutrally. And what do you do for the living? For a living, he said, and regretted correcting the minor error. I'm a professor. Mathematics, logic, and probability. A logician. How wonderful. So if when you die in your dream, then you die in your sleep, then if you die in your sleep, do you die in your dream? She asked rhythmically, as if it were a poem. He was distracted by the rhythm, but he untangled the sentence and said, No, that doesn't follow. It's A implies B versus B implies A. The converse, not the same as the original proposition. Converse, like in conversation? She asked. Not quite, he said, but he wondered if they had the same root. Maybe he could look it up. He started to reach for his phone, but she touched his arm lightly and asked in her slightly off accent, and where was it you taught? He thought, but could not quite remember. And come to that, where exactly were they, and who was she? He felt some alarm and started to move to get up. So, professor, she said, and put just a little downward pressure on him. Here we are in the conversing. Suppose you think you were dreaming and you try to wake up. Are you sure you will like what you find? Could someone die in his sleep but live on in his dream? What would you bet? And she pushed the cafetiere over to him and smiled. He paused for a couple of moments to think. It seems foolish to risk it, he said to her at last, and poured himself some more coffee.
I'm John Franz.
And I'm Kim O'Callaghan.
And this story is Dragon Rising by S.E. Gilby. Alex came from a good family, the kind that sits straight-backed in the front pew at church and makes it very clear that they are listening properly to the sermon. Their father was a banker who was very fond of meetings. Their mother volunteered for a charity for disadvantaged children. Alex's siblings were much older, a daughter and son who'd left home as soon as they could and seldom returned to visit. Alex was adopted, a disadvantaged child from their mother's charity.
A mistake,
their mother admitted to her best friend in a moment of weakness that she soon regretted, for her best friend was a terrible gossip.
We didn't need a third child. Reginald didn't even want a third child, but no one else wanted her, and I thought it was our duty.
Alex grew up obsessed with dragons. Dragon was their first word. They used to run through the fields trying to follow the wild dragons that flew overhead. They read every book about dragons that they could find in the library and drew endless pictures of them. When they were old enough, they studied them at school.
When I grow up, I want to be a dragon keeper,
Alex declared at breakfast one morning.
Well, they won't have you,
their mother said.
They don't employ girls for that sort of thing. Far too dangerous. I'm not a girl,
Alex pointed out.
Not today. Not today, no. But who knows what you'll be tomorrow?
And that was the problem with Alex, as far as everyone was concerned. The reason why no one else would adopt them. The reason why their mother regretted taking them in. Volcassianism, the charity's doctor had diagnosed. Also known as fluctuating gender. A most unusual condition. The child must have been exposed to a large amount of magic when in the womb.
But what gender is it?
Their mother had asked, exasperated. That will depend from day to day.
But what are we to put on the birth certificate?
Both? Neither. Instead, their mother decided to put down that Alex was a girl, and then tried to raise them as such. It did not go well.
Dragons change gender, too,
Alex had pointed out as soon as they were old enough to know this.
They can be boys or girls or neither, depending on how they feel about it. Well, you're not a dragon, are you?
Their mother hissed. It only got worse as Alex approached adolescence, and it became impossible for their parents to disguise that they weren't always a girl. The local villagers grew increasingly alarmed by this strange child in their midst. Who knows what kind of person the birth mother was? Harvey, the landlord of the Drunken Stoat, demanded to know one evening when his pub was full of locals letting off steam at the end of a tedious day's work.
I don't hold with this kind of thing at all,
Betty, the school nurse, replied. She didn't normally drink during the week, but Alex had come to her that day with a migraine, and she was quite unsettled.
It's not respectable. They should send the child away. It would be much better for everyone.
In the end, that's exactly what Alex's parents did. After the village children had grown to bullying Alex so badly that Alex ended up with a broken arm. But the boarding school they sent Alex to was no better. They were sent home by the indignant nuns after only a couple of weeks.
This is an all-girls school,
the mother superior coldly informed Alex's parents.
We don't accept boys.
But she is a girl,
Alex's mother protested.
Not all the time, madam.
Couldn't you have at least have pretended?
Alex's mother dragged Alex into the car with a bruising grip.
No,
Alex replied. They weren't paying attention to their mother, but to the flight of wild dragons flying overhead.
Well, you'll just have to go to the local comp. No private school will have you, not now words got out about you.
The local comprehensive school was in the nearest large town. It was hell on earth for Alex. As much as possible, they skived off and spent their time playing by themselves in the woods, where no one looked for them. They made friends with the local wild dragons, who learned to look for them and would surround Alex in a rainbow of swirling magic. Alex would read stories to them and sing songs, and the dragons would try to teach Alex their magic. Meanwhile, Alex's parents were unraveling. They were being shunned by the villagers because of Alex. Their mother was asked to not volunteer for the charity anymore. At the bank, their father found himself sidelined, excluded from important meetings. Then there was a campaign to get Alex and their family to leave the village.
But my family has lived here for 100 years!
Their mother was horrified. The campaign was secretive and spiteful, and no one really knew who was behind it. There were posters put up.
"Keep our children safe,"
said one.
"What if it's contagious?" asked another.
No one openly approved of the campaign, nor of the brick thrown through the family's kitchen window, nor of the paint thrown over the father's expensive car. No one said out loud the things that the campaign was suggesting. But no one did anything to stop the campaign either. No one bothered to find out who had started it. It was Miss Pettison, a sweet old retired lady whose amiable smile hid a deep well of bitterness and spite. Besides, once the campaign got started, most of the villagers took surreptitious part. It wasn't Miss Pettison who threw the brick, nor the paint. Alex disappeared just before their 14th birthday. The parents let it be known that they'd sent their child abroad to a religious institution that didn't mind fluctuating gender.
"They're much more accepting of that kind of thing over there,"
their mother told her best friend, Miss Pettison, who had shown her loyalty by continuing to visit throughout the entire nasty business.
"Alex will be happier and doing God's work, which is so important."
Miss Pettison sincerely doubted that God wanted Alex doing his work, but she kept quiet and nodded her head and sipped her tea. She knew that Harvey would express that thought for her when she told him everything later down at the Drunken Stoat. As time passed, Alex's parents gradually became accepted into village life once more. Their father was invited to meetings again. Their mother rejoined the charity. They visited their two older children in the city. Their daughter gave them their first grandchild. Their son got engaged to be married. They sat straight back in the front pew at church on Sundays and listened intently to the sermon. Nearly a year passed. The fire happened on a Monday night, and only Alex's parents were home. The fire burned so ferociously that the home was a blackened shell by the time the firefighters had put it out. They found two bodies in the rubble of the bedroom, and a third one in what would once have been the coal cellar.
"They'd locked Alex up in there,"
Betty, the school nurse, told an astonished audience in the Drunken Stoat. She was dating one of the firefighters, and he told her everything.
"All that nonsense about finding some foreign place as it would take them? That was all lies."
"So then, it was Alex that set the fire?" Harvey asked.
"No, it couldn't have been. There was nothing in the cellar that could you use to light a fire. Not even any coal, ironically. Besides, Alex died too."
"It might be for the best," Harvey mused. "At least we can all sleep safe in our beds tonight."
The others agreed. Only Miss Pettison shed a tear for the death of her good friend, Alex's mother. They never did find out how the fire had started. No one had noticed the wild dragons flying high above the house that night. Dragons are often drawn to fires, and the firefighters were focused on trying to tame the flames. They never thought of dragon fire, nor of dragon magic. No one noticed the new dragon hatchling that emerged from the flames. Alex, reborn. No one heard, over the roar of the fire, the joyful song with which the flight of wild dragons welcomed Alex into their midst. And no one saw them fly far away from the burning home, never to return.
Hello, this is Carrie Lawson, reading In the Blue Buzz by James Van Pelt. I went to the gym on the day before the world ended. No one greeted me at the door when I came in, but I scanned in my member number anyway, surprised that the place was open. The bank of elliptical machines was empty except for a young woman in a college sweatshirt and pink running shorts who worked the pedals hard, pushed the handles quickly, efficiently, sweat dripping from her chin and elbows. One of the salesmen sat at his desk, signing up a couple for a new membership. This is the day before the world ended. Everyone knew it was ending. The man took out his credit card. "We'll sign up for the month-long trial," he said. "It's on the house," said the salesman. "Run it anyways," said the man. Today was for my upper body, so I did sets on the bench press, lat machine, and upright row. As I strained at the weight, a haiku came to me whole. I stopped to write it down. I'd been told a writer should always have a notebook with him. Summer dies in wind. A green field of corn burns brown. Dead stalks fall in rows. My shoulders ached as I left. I needed ibuprofen. When I passed Warehouse 25, a bar in town, the parking lot was half full at 10 a.m. So was the parking lot at St. Anne's, the Catholic Church on North Avenue. Pretty busy for a Tuesday, but not all that surprising, considering. At the pharmacy, I stood behind an old guy who leaned on his walker. He picked up a new prescription to lower his cholesterol. I noticed he'd tucked a box of nicotine patches under his arm. "I've been meaning to quit," he said. The sky outside didn't look any different. Light, wispy clouds. They say that Morrigan is about 12 miles wide, but that's an estimate. They named it after some Celtic mythical figure. All Ragnarok-y of the astronomers, I thought. The fuzzy pictures show what looks like a bowling pin. Not that the shape matters much. The asteroid that killed the dinosaurs was half the size. They also say that it will only take a few seconds to punch through the atmosphere, so there won't be much time to watch it. A car roared past the pharmacy, going at least 100 miles an hour. Convertible with the top down, a couple people in the front seat. The road ends in a T intersection a half mile farther, but I guess they knew that. I waited at the light on 5th and Main. A woman pushed a stroller across the street in front of me. She adjusted the canopy to keep the sun off her baby's face. She nodded, and I waved back. "Nice day," she called to me. "Indeed." The golf course smelled of fresh-cut lawn. A groundsman steered a tractor down the 16th fairway, grass flying from the mowers. A threesome stood in the rough. Their golf bags dangled from their shoulders. They looked like high school kids. Ditching school, no doubt. Why not? Last chance to get a round in. Somewhere, someone screamed. Maybe on the golf course. It ululated, echoed, and hardly sounded human. I couldn't think of a reason to go home, so I drove. Another haiku came to me. A million leaves fall. A vast tree is stripped. Barren. Its sap heart beats slow. My writing professor had asked me earlier in the quarter if I wanted to write for an audience or for myself, as if it was a Zen riddle. "Most writing is never read," he said. "And what is popular, the world quickly forgets." I ended up back at the glass-fronted athletic club. The elliptical machines face the parking lot, I suppose so people can see other people working out. The woman in the sweatshirt and pink running shorts wasn't alone anymore. Four others had joined her, working their machines hard. Outside, I couldn't hear them. No whirring metal, no measured breathing, all visual. Sustained effort, as if they planned on staying on their ellipticals until tomorrow. I caressed the steering wheel. If I took the car a few blocks away from the club and then turned around, I could have it up to 100 miles an hour before the street ended. Or I could go into Warehouse 25. They make a mean Moscow mule. Ginger beers and vodka until the end wouldn't be the worst way to spend my time. I could go to St. Anne's. No family, no close friends. It would just be me, but isn't that the same for all of us? I mean, when you come right down to it, no one really shares your last moment. Emily Dickinson said she heard a fly buzz when she died. She called it a blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz. It comes down to that. I turned the car onto Main. The air washed through the window, stirring a hamburger wrapper on my back seat. How could I describe that? What verb would work? Did it rasp? Did it crackle? Did it scrape? That's how a writer thinks. That is, if I was a writer. How would I ever know? I was still taking my first class. I slid down the street thoughtfully, 15 miles per hour in a 30 miles per hour zone. If anyone pulled up behind me, they'd be pissed. Lots of shops were closed. No cars in their parking lots, no lights inside, but the bagel shops open glowed. I pulled in. They make a mean cup of coffee. The bagels are excellent. I took my notebooks in with me, ordered an onion bagel, toasted and buttered, and then set it on a back table. A blank piece of paper invites the hand. It asks for ink. Today would be a good day to start that novel. I wrote Chapter 1 on the top of the first sheet. Paused for a moment, and then began writing.
This is Debbie Johnson. I'm reading The 1205 by G.O. Clark. Each night at 1205 sharp, the train whistle repeatedly blows a kind of Morse code warning to anything on the tracks up ahead in the darkness. It's a well-known fact that evil things are attracted to the sound and wander down the tracks towards it, the engine's lights pinning them like a stage actor's in the spotlight just before the curtain call. At daybreak, under the cloudless sky, the town folk start their day safe in the knowledge that the mess from the night before will have been cleared away, the zombie hordes shy a few more members, the morning train right on schedule.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.